Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who graces this program each week with her uncommon intelligence, I am very grateful to her for saying, is Diana West. She is, of course, the author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, a longtime syndicated columnist who blogs with great effect at dianawest.net and appears frequently at the Daily Caller and elsewhere. Always grateful for her appearances here. Diana, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us again.
Yes, wonderful to be with you.
You have been trying doggedly to make sense, as I think we all must, about what's been going on with respect to the FBI and the intelligence community as it relates to this so-called collusion business with the Russians, and the figure that you have fingered principally in some of your recent writings is John Brennan, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. You've stitched these together in a series you call The Red Thread. Catch us up on your latest thinking about Brennan and what role he's been playing in all of this.
Yes, well, Brennan, I think, has fingered himself in his extraordinary activities to, it seems, create the Russian collusion narrative. He seems to be a creator, and then to organize a what's called a working group, an interagency working group at CIA headquarters that brought across agency boundaries, FBI, NSA, and CIA elements, to spy, study, follow the Trump campaign on this Russian collusion wild goose chase.
A goose chase that, to be clear, it seems he had a hand in manufacturing as well.
That's what's so incredible. I mean, we don't have all the pieces yet, but this is, if you're trying to put the mosaic together, this is where a logical read of the pieces is pointing. And this becomes so crucial to really focus on and hope we get oversight help and prosecutorial help if necessary, or relief, as I should say, because we now have the new piece of the puzzle coming with the revelation that Stephen Halper, who is called a longtime CIA asset, was being run, it seems, by the FBI inside Trump world, reporting back. Was he part of this working group during the campaign without the even pretext that was later put on paper to inaugurate this spying operation? This I'm thinking of this more, frankly, in terms of active measures, the old Soviet term for absolutely creating out of whole cloth all manner of espionage and mischief, because we're not looking at simple spying. We're looking at the creation of the appearance of wrongdoing, a false narrative.
Diana, it was very helpful. Our friend Andy McCarthy had a terrific piece over the weekend in which he sort of disputed the argument that, you know, Hillary Clinton has been treated very unfairly and Donald Trump has been given preferential treatment by all these characters. And he reminds us that John Brennan played a very important role in promoting this whole notion that the DNC, Democratic National Committee, servers were penetrated and exploited by the Russians, something that has not been independently documented, I think it's fair to say, forensically, even though we're endlessly told that the entire intelligence community agrees that that's what happened. You know, again, it does have the sort of sniff of active measures going on here when there was no independent forensic investigation of those servers that would confirm that indeed they were penetrated. Perhaps it's as likely, it seems to me, as that it was this Pakistani national who had Debbie Wasserman Schultz's passwords and did it as an inside job. It's far from clear that there's any there, but But your point about the red thread is that this has seemingly continued to the present moment, with Brennan now becoming, it seems, more and more unhinged in his accusations of the president.
And threats to Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan in his most recent Twitter rant, yes. Absolutely. And, you know, you think about this in terms of this bureaucrat making threats against elected representatives, whether they're in the Congress or the White House.
Talk about those threats.
Yes. Well, this was essentially a call out to Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell not to allow Donald Trump to continue. I mean, it really beggars belief. We've never seen a responsible or supposedly responsible senior official of his particular job description, former CIA director, behave in this way. And yes, unhinged is the word. The CIA involvement, I believe, must be unpacked here in the most public way possible. They know at Langley what the truth is. There are people who know, who can answer these questions. And another one, we're starting to see more interest again in my favorite power couple, Bruce and Nellie Orr. Bruce Orr being the senior justice official who was essentially a liaison between Christopher Steele and the justice FBI organizations, and his wife, Nellie Orr, who worked for GPS Fusion as a Russia expert, ham radio operator, and in her academic life, a Nepologist for Stalin.
And of course, GPS Fusion was the outfit that produced the so-called Steele dossier, again, around which much of this false narrative, it appears, of a Russian collusion and the compromise of the president at the time, candidate Trump.
Yes, and Nellie Orr has the Also, I must add, has the CIA affiliation in 2010. We know from public document that she was involved with the CIA. We don't know the extent of that involvement, but especially with the helper story and the CIA working group at Langley spying on the Trump campaign, Nellie Orr needs to be fleshed out into the open in terms of, was she working for the CIA? Does she know John Brennan personally? How deep is this CIA organization of this domestic spying on political opposition? I mean,
Let me ask you, Diana West, because we're almost out of time. This almost certainly will involve further exposure of what the CIA was doing during this period. Does it concern you that one of John Brennan's acolytes and a person he has very aggressively promoted to be the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Gina Haspel, has just been confirmed by the Senate to that job?
You bet it does. I think that was an absolutely disastrous choice for that role, given that pedigree alone, but for other reasons as well. And yes, this does make it very difficult, but not impossible.
Well, it will not be impossible if there is proper congressional oversight, and it seems to me that at a minimum is required, as you say, perhaps some serious prosecutorial investigations as well. We will be following it closely. In fact, we'll be discussing it momentarily with our next guest, the great Joe DiGenova. But thank you for teeing this up for us, Diana West, and for the superb reporting that you're doing on this at dianawest.net. Check out The Red Thread, and also, of course, her masterwork, American Betrayal. Diana, we'll talk with you again next week. Next up, Joe DiGenova, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a great pleasure to say we are joined by Joseph DiGenova, an attorney by training, a career professional in the law enforcement and judicial business, particularly serving as a U.S. attorney and as a special counsel and investigator in a variety of roles, notably in the United States Congress. You have seen him everywhere. He is an extraordinarily authoritative, knowledgeable, and quite gutsy analyst of the various conspiracies that have been unfolding before our eyes, going back to the Clinton scandals with emails, and including, of course, what has been alleged about the Trump campaign, what was done to it, and, of course, the cover-up that seems to have been operating in the months following the president's election, all of which is now coming into sharp relief in connection with the special counsel investigation of Robert Mueller. Joe DiGenova, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Frank. Anything for you.
Thank you. Listen, you have called to mind something really important that is largely now lost to memory for most of us. Tell us about Susan Rice's last day on the job as National Security Advisor to the President Obama.
Well, you will recall famously that when originally confronted with leaks about the fact that American citizens had been unmasked through illegal NSA electronic surveillance, and that the identities of those Americans and the contents of their telephone and email messages had been leaked, Susan Rice famously denied knowing anything about it. Within a matter of days, she confirmed that she did know about it and that it was all legal. You may see in that answer a strain of logic and a public explication that matches that of Mr. Clapper, who said none of this ever happened. And now he's saying that the spying on the campaign was good. Now, Susan Rice did something on Inauguration Day 2017. She wrote a memo to herself about a meeting that had occurred in the Oval Office on January the 5th, 2017, with President Obama, Vice President Biden, FBI Director Comey, Deputy Attorney General Yates, and herself, Susan Rice. That memo is a classic cover your fanny memo where she repeats statements by President Obama that everything they did was done, quote, by the book. This is a memo that will live in infamy, because by doing this memo, she created perhaps the single most valuable piece of evidence against the former president of the United States and others that made him aware that the spying that is now being revealed, he knew about and did not stop. I cannot imagine ever having why anybody would write that memo. I go back and I think about it and I say, thank God Susan Rice is that stupid. Because what she did on that day was to confirm everything we once suspected and now know is true, that there was a brazen plot to exonerate Hillary Clinton from her email server scandal so that she could win. And if she lost the election, they were going to frame Donald Trump and try to impeach him. There is no more insidious plot in the history of the United States other than the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. I was thinking yesterday as I was going through my notes in anticipation of an interview, and I came across this note about the Rice memorandum to the file. It is going to become the equivalent of the typewriter of Alger Hiss. This is amazing. When you think about what is in that memo, it absolutely establishes beyond any doubt that President Obama was aware of all of the counterintelligence and illegal activities that were underway.
And Joe, what you're saying is that it wasn't just that he learned about them on the 5th of January. It was that he, with this document, indicates that he had been a party to these actions and the decisions that led to them long before.
Yes, and in fact, what it will eventually lead to is the deconstruction of John Brennan's what can only be described as psychotic rants over the last couple of months. I cannot imagine a former director of Central Intelligence acting the way Brennan has. He has actually, by his very abusive conduct and comments, created the evidence of motivation for him to have done illegal things while he was in office. And coupling that with the incredible musings of James Clapper, you end up with quite a little cabal of very evil and nasty people.
And Joe, you're seeing, as you say, these people becoming more and more unhinged. I certainly, in the case of Brennan, and it will be very interesting as Clapper does his book tour now, whether that is true of him as well, that bespeaks a level of increasing, well, maybe they're frantic, but certainly concern about what is being exposed in the way of their culpability. Would you say that seems a reasonable conclusion to draw?
Absolutely. And I think apropos of this, and I think the reason that they are so upset is that the disclosure of the Stefan Halper spying operation on the Trump campaign, which it clearly was, this was not an effort to find out what the Russians were doing. This was an effort to find out what the Trump people were doing, which, of course, was nothing other than trying to run for president. But the revelation that Stefan Halper, the CIA FBI spy, has actually just put them into paroxysms of mendacity. They are now lying to such an extent about the reason for this plot. They now have to admit that there was a plot. They don't call it that. They call it, oh, well, this is a wonderful counterintelligence operation against the Russians. This was a counterintelligence operation against the candidate for president of the opposing party of Barack Obama. Make no mistake about it. And I must tell you, I am so disappointed in Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein for what I consider to be the most incompetent management of the Department of Justice and this scandal, for them to have to be forced into looking at something that is so patently obvious. It took the president of the United States had to tweet that he was going to demand an inquiry into whether or not there had been spying. Ask yourself this question. What qualified investigator at the department would not have already started investigating that months ago? And the answer is Rosenstein is an anti-Trumper. You can't fire him right now, because if he did, you'd have a political firestorm. But Rosenstein is committing suicide, and Jeff Sessions is, sad to say, absent without leave.
Well, let me ask you about this, Joe, because I'm, to be honest with you, still an admirer of Jeff Sessions, have long been, and consider him to be the only anchor at Windward, to Windward in that department at the moment. To what extent is the explanation that he has recused himself from many, if not all, of these matters, at least somewhat expiating the charge here that he's AWOL?
At a certain point, you go beyond that. This now is so big and so important and so beyond whatever happened during the campaign. It is now clear that this matter has exceeded the small notions of the cover-up of the Hillary Clinton email server and has expanded into a massive criminal enterprise aimed at the heart of a sitting president. So this activity continued after Inauguration Day and after the election. As far as I'm concerned, anything that happens after Inauguration Day is new business. And since the conspiracy continued after Inauguration Day, everything after that is new business, and Mr. Sessions is not recused. And if he doesn't assert himself into this process and say, ladies and gentlemen, I'm in, he's going to be remembered as the most feckless, useless attorney general in history.
And that seems eminently sensible to me, Joe, but I just wonder whether the authorities vested in Mueller, seemingly limitless authorities, don't actually countermand that reasonable cutoff on the subjects on which he has recused himself, Jeff Sessions, that is.
The way you find out is say you're going to do it and then see what Mr. Mueller says. And if Mr. Mueller says you can't do it, you say, Mr. Mueller, you're wrong. I'm the attorney general. You're not. You're a special employee. And if you don't shut up, I'm going to fire you. Now, Jeff Sessions will never do that.
I have to say, Joe, I'm not sure that's true. I sense that there's a deep frustration on his part about lots of what's going on in that department. And I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing to say. He should be doing more. I would certainly like to see him doing more. And maybe what you've done is lay out a basis upon which he can do it. But two things. One is I don't think that he's not doing those things out of some misplaced affection for the agency he serves as the AG on. And secondly, most especially, I don't think the solution, at least for the moment, with Rod Rosenstein still in place, is to fire Jeff Sessions, which some of my dear friends are calling for.
I would not urge that Jeff Sessions be fired, and I would not even urge that Rosenstein be fired. And the reason is the political firestorm from that would be bad for the president. The president has control now of the situation as a result of the meetings with Rosenstein and others at the White House over the last couple of weeks, using General Kelly to broker access to key documents for members of the House Intelligence Committee. But you see, at a certain point in a presidency, when you have something like this going on, which is so obvious to the body politic that this was a criminal enterprise to undo an election by illegal means, the Attorney General of the United States is the essential player in all of that, not the chairman of the House and Senate committees. The Attorney General of the United States is the president's representative as the chief law enforcement officer. He must explain why he is stepping in, or he must publicly explain why he is not. One of the things that he and Rod Rosenstein do not do, and do not apparently have the capability of doing, is talking to the American people about the single most important national security, beyond the foreign policy questions, to our country. Was there an effort to unseat a duly elected president of the United States? I have answered that question in the affirmative.
Joe DeGenova, it's so good to talk with you, and I look forward to doing so again. In the meantime, stay well. Keep up your great work.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of our duty experts on matters involving Latin America, but specifically Venezuela, much in the news at the moment, and news is the business he's in, of course. We're talking about Russ Dallin. He is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Latin America Herald Tribune. He is also the head of an international investment bank, Caracas Capital, and one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. We're grateful for his expertise, especially as a man who has long been involved on the ground in Venezuela to take stock of the latest developments there, including a so-called election victory of Nicolas Maduro, the increasingly autocratic, indeed, I would argue, despotic ruler of that country, who won a smashing electoral victory, we're told. So, Russ Dallin, help us unpack this. Where does the truth lie on the election in Venezuela and the prospects that this is conferring some long absent legitimacy on this government?
So it has not gone well, as demonstrated by yesterday's events of Nicolas Maduro expelling the highest representative of the U.S. in the country, Ambassador Todd Robinson, and the head of political affairs there in the embassy. Because he is dissatisfied that the world is not recognizing his farce of an election, where the opposition parties were all banned from participating. Not only was the opposition party banned from participating, but some of the most popular opposition politicians were also banned or incapacitated from participating because they were in jail or because they're under house arrest or just out of pure spite. So what better way to go to election than to be able to pick your opponents?
Right. And dominate the media and bribe voters and threaten other voters and otherwise, I mean, as you say, make a true farce of all of this. I have to say that his retaliation by expelling Todd Robinson is something of a mixed bag as far as I'm concerned. I've long thought that he was not a very good choice for our representative there, given his leftist sympathies and his machinations in Guatemala not so long ago, his previous post. But this is of a piece with apparently the expulsion of a number of other nations' representatives as well, if I'm not mistaken, and it seems to reflect what I understand is also the Organization of American States' repudiation of this election. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I mean, the election has been widely condemned as a farce and illegitimate by everyone from the 15-nation Lima group, which is the group of nations, the biggest nations in Latin America around Venezuela, calling it a farce and not recognizing the outcome, to the European Union and all its member states also saying the same thing. And of course, the United States and Canada and the U.S. having put sanctions on previously as one of the most powerful men in Venezuela was finally sanctioned on Friday before the election. And that's Diosdado Cabello, who is the Wall Street Journal put on the front page a couple of years ago. One of our old reporters, by the way, who works for the Journal now, basically outing him as the drug kingpin and capo of the Cartel de Sols, basically the military drug cartel.
Operating in and with the help of the Venezuelan government. Does the fact that the OAS has declined to recognize this election and its outcome translate into a heightened opportunity that the nations of the hemisphere will join to, well, intervene in some way of this catastrophe of as you've talked with us about over the past year or so, the disaster that has now befallen the people of Venezuela, who are starving literally and for some in some cases fleeing the country to try to find gainful employment and a way to sustain themselves.
And you hit the nail on the head. The average salary now in Venezuela is less than $2 a month. You can't feed yourself, much less your family, or buy shoes or get the internet and read the news on that kind of salary. So people are basically voting with their feet and leaving by the millions this country. If you take not just flooding across the borders into Colombia where they are and sleeping on the streets because they don't have any right to work, or Brazil, also a local border, but they're also getting into Colombia and then taking buses elsewhere in Latin America. You take a Uber or a Lyft in Miami, and 9 out of 10 times, and that's actually a statistic that I have counted myself, you will get a Venezuelan driver because they have all fled here, and they can make more money driving a cab in Miami or cleaning toilets, as the president of Venezuela so elegantly called the people that have been traitors to the country and left, than starving on $2 a day in Venezuela.
Yeah, of course. So is an intervention in the works, do you think, or at least is it what's required at this point to try to stave off this unfolding disaster?
Sadly, Mr. Maduro denies that there are any problem, and as does the whole of the Venezuelan regime, says that there's no problem at all. Babies aren't dying of malnutrition, that everyone lives swimming in the sea of happiness, the same sea of happiness as Cuba. So that does not make it easy when your host nation rejects any kind of foreign aid. And the United States, as well as the OAS, as well as the UN and the World Health Organization have all asked to help, even the Catholic charity Caritas. They've all asked to try and help with this problem. And it's not just a matter of lack of food, but there's no medicine. There's no alcohol in the hospitals just for basic cleaning. There's no Band-Aids. There's no bandages. It's the country is literally falling apart. And that also includes its oil production, which is the only thing that keeps the lights on, which are barely on from only time to time, that they don't have enough parts to even keep those things running. So their oil production keeps circling the drain as it gets lower and lower and lower. We estimate that it'll be 1.3 million barrels a day this month, which is not enough to feed their population, because a lot of that's already promised to the Russians and the Chinese for loans that they have made to this country.
Well, I get all that, and I'm very, very troubled by it, as are obviously others in the region, especially those that are now facing the prospect of these large influxes of desperate people. But does this, just to put a fine point on it, Rustellan, maybe you don't know the answer or don't care to offer one, but it does seem to me, whether it's of a military kind or of some other, there has to be an intervention to try to prevent the widespread loss of life, a true humanitarian catastrophe in this country, as well as addressing, hopefully, in the process, the abuses of the government and the narco-trafficking and the rest of it. Do you think in the military there is any prospect, despite the presence of Cuban, you know, commissars and lots of loyalists to the regime, that they will see the imperative of trying to save their country from what's happening, hopefully with some help from the outside as well?
The U.S. government has definitely been asking for that, asking for the military to honor the Constitution, not the political party, and stand up for Venezuelans, basically calling on them to do that as their duty. That is the way these things have typically been handled in Latin America. But Mr. Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, came to fame and fortune because he himself had led a coup and then knew how to coup-proof the army with Cuban intelligence officers. There's over 30,000 Cubans in Venezuela, and their main job is they're all throughout the army monitoring and signal intelligence to basically prevent any kind of coup. And indeed, the Venezuelan government regime has arrested hundreds of military officers over the last 6 months and thrown them in jail for risk that they might have been trying to lead a coup. It's a difficult road to hedge. It's the simplest solution, but as of yet, you know, that we've had trouble with getting the Castros out of power in Cuba, and they're very much assisting in running that ship in Venezuela.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you to look at the alternatives. The administration, the U.S. government under Donald Trump, has just imposed a new round of sanctions. Russ Dahlen, first of all, how effective do you think they will be in really ratcheting up the pressure on the Maduro regime? And what else might we do, short of an intervention, to make this even more untenable for the government there now?
The sanctions that were passed or were under executive order yesterday signed by President Trump were basically to stop U.S. persons and U.S. entities from purchasing Venezuelan assets, mainly Citgo, which means they can't sell it to the Russians. The Russians already have a lien on 50% of Citgo. This basically prevents them from selling any of their U.S. assets or any of their assets throughout the world to a U.S. entity. And we have a far reaching, when you say U.S. entity, it can be subsidiaries or related companies. We have a very wide reach in that. But that doesn't stop the Russians or the Chinese from buying those. The Chinese have not been anxious to put any more money in after they've seen $65 billion going to this sinkhole in the ocean. And they're not exactly happy with their investment. As of yesterday, they had yet to send even congratulations.
But I understand they have called for the world to recognize Maduro's elections.
Well, they say it's an internal affair of the country, and they don't have any comment on it. But the world should recognize the domestic processes of countries, however they may be. The Russians, however, were immediate in their congratulations, as would be expected, and they see in Venezuela the possibility to stick a finger in the eye of the United States and also grab control of a country with the largest oil reserves in the world.
Not a trivial thing. Russ Dahlen, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your expertise and the work you do reporting on all of this at the Latin American Herald Tribune and your visits with us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Jose Cardenas, another of our experts on Latin America, about both Venezuela and what's happening in neighboring Colombia, an election there in Nicaragua, and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Jose Cardenas, one of our duty experts on developments in Latin America, is with us, I'm pleased to say. Jose has served in a number of capacities in senior ranks of the United States government, in the Department of State, at the National Security Council, and at the U.S. Agency for International Development, where he acted as an assistant administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean. He has brought all of that expertise to not only his role as an associate with Vision America, but to a blog that he posts at Foreign Policy Magazine's Shadow Government site. It's always good to have him with us. Jose, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be here, Frank.
Thank you. Let me ask you for your take. I spoke at some length about it with Russ Dahlen a moment ago, but just quickly, given what is developing in Venezuela now in the aftermath of this fraudulent election of Nicolas Maduro, would you be inclined to push at the minimum for further sanctions specifically aimed at the energy sector of this this regime, and particularly perhaps the export from the United States of refined products, which are vital to its continuing operations.
Yes, Frank, I think it's time for a fundamental reassessment of how not only the United States, but the region is approaching Venezuela. I think that the recent sham election really is an inflection point. I think the world is running out of time in Venezuela. What we're seeing in Venezuela is nothing less than the consolidation of another Cuba, another totalitarian regime in Latin America. So it's time to start thinking, more seriously about how we're going to resolve this problem. To date, as you know, Frank, that the approach of the United States has been steady ratcheting up of individual sanctions against Venezuelan officials and some efforts to impede the Maduro regime's ability to acquire outside financing. The golden goose, the mother lode, of course, with Venezuela is the oil sector. Now, when you raise the oil sector, of course, you start getting considerations about the world price and how it's going to affect international markets. But with the glut of oil, despite the uptick in prices, really lends itself to a reconsideration of going after what remains of the Venezuelan oil sector. It's a profoundly symbolic at this point because of low production in Venezuela, but also it is really eliminating, it would eliminate the last remaining vestige of the Venezuelan economy. I think it's time, in short, to go after the Venezuelan oil sector.
Yeah. Well, with a view to, of course, in short order, hopefully, bringing about the end of this horrific regime, which has brought such hardship on its people.
Well, Frank, if I could just add one thing on that before we leave the issue of Venezuela, I think that all that remains for decent people abroad is to hope that the Venezuelan military moves to remove this regime. Now, in polite company, you're not supposed to talk about coup d'etat in Latin America. But the fact is that a move by the military to restore constitutional order in Venezuela is really the only thing we have left.
Yeah, it is. And the question, I guess, is what can be done from the outside to help foster that kind of turnabout by the Venezuelan military? We talked about Rustel, and he was not terribly hopeful for it at the moment, but particularly given the presence of Cubans throughout the institution. Before we get to Cuba, and I do want to talk with you about that quickly, if I can, Jose Cardenas, let me just ask you about Colombia. Rustallen mentioned that there are large numbers of Venezuelans who have fled across the border into Colombia. That nation is having a presidential election this weekend. Give us a sense, if you can, as to how that looks for the people and government of Colombia to have this hardship inflicted upon them and what that might mean for the polls.
Yes, very good question. The Colombia has, without question, suffered as a result of the economic meltdown in Venezuela with thousands upon thousands of Venezuelans fleeing and then being a charge, if you will, to the Colombian government, thousands and thousands of refugees in a very, very rural part of the country. It's a huge headache for Bogota. The positive impact, using that word loosely, is that all of the turmoil in Venezuela is giving impetus or giving motivation, giving momentum to right-of-center forces in Colombia, which is good for the United States, because what has happened under the previous president in Colombia is a drift leftward. And that meant the appeasement of the narco-terrorist FARC in the so-called peace process. It meant appeasement of the Maduro government in Venezuela, which was a facilitator of the peace process. So the right of center forces in Colombia are looking good going into this election, which again is very positive for the United States, because that government, a right of center government in Colombia, is going to be more amenable and is going to want to work with Washington to pursue the policies that worked in Colombia in repressing the narco-terrorist FARC and getting that country back on the right track in terms of counter-narcotics.
Yeah. Do you think this would result in the repudiation of this very problematic so-called peace agreement with the FARC?
It may not mean the shredding of the agreement, but it's going to lead to a more conservative, judicious application of the peace process. In other words, very, very lesser tolerance for the FARC and its efforts to, again, maximize its own opportunities as a result of the peace process.
Yeah, this includes, as you know very well, Jose Cardenas, the apprehension recently of one of their top leaders with something like a ton of cocaine that he was bringing into the United States, as I recall. So this really demonstrates the fraud that has been perpetrated, and I think the people of Colombia have seen through it. Let me turn to another fraud, and that is the regime that has been misruling Nicaragua for a long time, Jose. The people there have evidently had their fill of it. There's a back and forth going on at the moment between the government and the opposition. Where do you think things stand, and where are they likely to head?
Well, Nicaragua is an interesting example of the same type of systematic destruction of democracy that we've seen in Venezuela. But the fact is, it has been done a lot more secretively. In other words, Daniel Ortega, who many of your listeners will remember from the old days, who has reinvented himself as a Democrat, small D Democrat in Nicaragua, has nevertheless undertaken a very Chavez-like program to undermine democracy and again, eliminate checks and balances. So we've seen the same process in Nicaragua. There has been a spark brought about by really an innocuous reform of the Social Security system that nevertheless led to people saying, enough is enough. So now what we're seeing in Nicaragua today is the Catholic Church has stepped in and is trying to negotiate a some sort of a transition back to democracy. Ortega is a wily autocrat. We are at a standstill right now as to whether he is going to leave power, which is very doubtful. But the Nicaraguan opposition forces are saying, we don't want a return to autocracy. We want a return to democracy.
Right. It'll be very interesting to watch. The Pope, of course, played a rather unhelpful role in that peace process that we were talking about a moment ago in Colombia. I'm not sure that it will be better behaved or more productive in this case, but we'll watch it closely, as I know will you. We've run out of time to talk with you about Cuba. I'm sorry to say, Jose Cardenas, but we'd love to have you back soon to talk about the transition there, whether there's really any change or any prospect for change in the future. Thank you. In the meantime, come back to us again soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.